Lisboa, Bruxelles, Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Hello and welcome to the Europeans, the podcast that promises a smoother journey around Europe than any of our roads, railways or skies can offer. We're here to transport you, painlessly, I hope, via your ears. Your drivers today are Dominic Kramer, me, and Katie Lee. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Do we think that our sort of intro metaphors are getting out of control?
Yes, almost certainly. But at least I went for transport and not another food one like you do almost every week.
It's true. Well, there's so many good food analogies to be had, but I like this, Dominic.
Good.
Choo-choo.
I'm glad. Well, how are you doing there? You were late, but and do you want to tell listeners why you were late?
I was just drifting off, sitting here staring into space, really, and looking at my fringe in the preview of this call, wondering if it needs a cut. Is that a good excuse?
It's a really good excuse. Better than any, I think.
What's going on with you over there in Amsterdam?
Oh, I'm just sick again. I know I was sick last week, so it feels a bit pathetic. But I did get better in between, and then I got a second cold. I think it's just that time of year where there are so many viruses around, and it's that time of year where I realise being an opera singer and being on stage with loads of other people singing is just like the worst super spready viral thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's probably up there with being a teacher as one of the riskiest jobs for colds.
Oh, commiserations. I'm sorry
Thank
to hear
you.
That.
Anyway, I see you've been busy, Katie. You've launched a newsletter.
I have. It's quite scary. It feels a bit vulnerable. Like, I haven't launched a new thing since I started The Europeans. And that time I had you for company. This time I'm all on my own.
I literally just read it before we started recording while you were fixing your fringe. And I loved it. It's so fun. Really nice to meet. I mean, I don't live in Paris. For people who don't know what this is, which is everyone, I guess, it's a newsletter about Paris.
Yeah, it's a newsletter about Paris, like mostly local politics and urban policy, stuff like that. But also I'm hoping we'll have some, you know, kind of fun things from time to time. And it is indeed aimed primarily at people who live here in the City of Light. But you might find it interesting if you're just, you know, someone who's visited Paris or someone who's interested in the life of cities in general. And the first issue just dropped. It's about Airbnb and whether or not the city's limits on Airbnb have actually made it easier or not to find an apartment. So it ties in quite well with the podcast that we made quite recently about housing policy. And I guess I'm going to be brave and put a link in the show notes.
Yay, do it. Be brave. And actually, it's one of two newsletters that's being launched this week from this team, right?
Yeah, the Europeans will be launching a new newsletter tomorrow.
Big breaking news. Yeah, we're finally jumping into the land of newsletters. It's going to be headed up by our wonderful producer, Morgan Childs. And it's going to be a nice addition to this podcast, like where we discuss some of the things that we haven't had space for here, come back to a few stories maybe that we talked about on the show a few weeks ago. To be totally honest with you, we've been resisting calls to launch a newsletter for about 7 years. And it feels like quite a big step to be adding this to our workload. But I feel like the time is right and we've got a good idea. I think it's going to be great.
So subscribe at the link in the show notes to get it in your inbox on Friday mornings. Newsletters aside, what are we talking about this week?
Well, you may or may not have noticed, but the annual climate change summit COP, the 30th edition, closed in Brazil last week. The summit did end with an agreement, but a compromise agreement that didn't include any explicit mention of the F words, fossil fuels, something that is a big disappointment to the scientists and climate campaigners who were hoping for something more. And honestly, it feels a bit like big, bold climate policy ideas have just slipped out of fashion lately. Though that's sadly not because the threat is any less urgent. So later on in the show, Katie is calling up German climate activist Luisa Neubauer to help us understand why on earth this is happening. Luisa is a bit of a climate celebrity. She co-founded the German wing of Fridays for Future, the school strike climate movement that grew out of Greta Thunberg's weekly strikes when she was still at school. Katie will be speaking to Luisa about why she thinks there's been this vibe shift around climate change recently and how we can still hold on to hope. That's coming up later on in the show, but for now, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
Well, this is the segment of the show made in partnership this week with our radio friends at Euronet Plus. And yeah, a lot of the media is understandably focused this week on the controversial US peace plan for Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be talking about that this week because it's all changing so quickly that it would almost certainly be out of date by the time you're hearing this. But I am going to be talking about Europe's defense capabilities for Good Week. And I'm handing out a Good Week for military mobility in the European Union. After the European Commission, the EU's executive body, that's the part of the EU responsible for proposing new laws, they announced the creation of a military Schengen zone. Mm-hmm. So a zone that would make it much easier for military equipment and troops to cross EU borders from the strategic ports in the west of the continent to its eastern flank in the case of war.
So it's like passport-free travel for tanks, basically.
That's the idea. I mean, it wouldn't be completely paper trail free, but yeah, it's somewhere in that direction.
I mean, honestly, I kind of assumed there was something already in place that would mean that we'd be able to move troops and tanks and stuff quickly if we needed to. So, like, it's good, but it's also kind of alarming to hear that it doesn't exist already, you know, especially considering Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine and how, you know, we keep hearing that Russia could be preparing to attack a NATO country within the next decade.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, said over the summer that he thought Russia could be ready to attack a NATO country within 5 years. Mm. So I had a similar reaction to you to this news. I know that we're near the beginning of a huge build-up in military spending in Europe, but I didn't realise quite how unprepared Europe is for moving significant military resources across the continent if this were to suddenly become necessary. And we're not ready to move military resources across the continent for a number of reasons. Partly because of infrastructure problems on Europe's roads, bridges, railways, but also because of that thing we really love in Europe and love to hate, bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
According to the European Commission, some countries currently require 45 days advance notice in order to give the necessary permissions for the military to cross the border into their country.
That's amazing. That's like French bureaucracy speed. I mean, like, I mean, that is really the kind of number that doesn't help Europe fight back against Trump's accusations that we are maybe a little bit overregulated over here.
No, it doesn't. But on the other hand, we are talking about it today because it's going to be changed and improved.
Okay.
So that's something. And also, in a way, I can kind of understand why this is something that would have all these delays and checks and balances in place. Like, having another country's army and or their heavy military equipment enter into your country, even if it is just to travel through, that's quite something, especially considering we don't currently have an EU army.
Yeah, and especially considering our history of armies moving across this continent. Okay,
absolutely.
Yeah, I take some of my early alarm back a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing we should remember is that not every EU country is even a member of NATO. Mm-hmm. So Cyprus, Malta, and Ireland aren't NATO members. But actually, most significantly for this topic of crossing continental Europe, Austria is also not a member of NATO. So yeah, things can get complicated. Anyway, the plan is that the EU wants to bring this maximum 45 days of advance notice down to a maximum of 3 days.
Okay.
And they want to simplify the admin side of things so that only one single permission procedure is needed to cover transport through all 27 member states of the European Union. This would really streamline the process and make it much easier for the military to move from west to east quickly if needed.
I love how even this story is about streamlining administrative processes. Okay, so they are like slowly cutting away at that red tape.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that this problem is not just bureaucracy, though. You mentioned roads and bridges, things like that. What are they doing about those other things that would slow the military mobilization down?
Well, the EU has identified 2,800 transport infrastructure hotspots that need upgrades, and they've narrowed them down to 500 priority projects to invest in.
Gotta love those transport infrastructure hotspots. What is that in normal speak?
The hotspots refer to places where there might be transport bottlenecks. So the infrastructure projects will be things like strengthening bridges, widening tunnels, increasing capacity at ports and airports, generally removing the things that might slow down progress across the continent.
That all sounds quite expensive. I mean, good, but expensive.
Yeah, and it will be. They estimate that will cost around 100 billion euros.
Ooh.
But don't forget that all the NATO countries, apart from Spain, have agreed to up their defence spending to 5% of GDP by 2035. And these projects that improve military mobility are included as defence spending.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the event that Russia does attack a NATO country, how many troops, how much equipment do the EU expect would actually be crossing in concrete terms from west, presumably towards the east?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. And the EU hasn't actually announced the exact numbers or the routes that would be taken, which I guess makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to keep that kind of thing secret from your enemies. But I did see that the Financial Times had got some NATO diplomats to broadly confirm some estimated figures from analysts suggesting that there were plans for roughly 200,000 troops, 1,500 tanks, and more than 2,500 other pieces of armour potentially being shipped from the US, Canada, and the UK across mainland Europe in the scenarios that they're planning for. Of course, it all depends on like what the situation is. So this is conjecture. But to give an example of why this initiative of the EU Commission is really necessary, back in 2022, when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, France wanted to send some Leclerc tanks to Romania as part of strengthening this NATO battle group. But they couldn't transport the tanks via road through Germany due to some regulations about the weight of the vehicles. And instead, they had to transport the tanks via the Mediterranean Sea from Marseille to Greece and then by rail up to Romania.
Oh, that's painful.
It really is. And a journey that could have taken days instead took weeks.
Ugh.
So yeah, in the case of an urgent war situation, these delays can make a huge difference. And it's because of situations like this that whilst announcing these plans for a military Schengen area, the European Commissioner for Defence and Space, Andreas Kubilius, quoted the American World War I general, John Pershing, who said, "Infantry wins battles, logistics wins the war." These plans from the European Commission contain quite a few other steps I haven't mentioned, such as creating a fast-track procedure and priority access to key infrastructure in the case of war. And also, they're creating something called a military solidarity pool for shared transport and logistics. But yeah, it does seem like after many, many years of talking about wanting to make this kind of thing happen, both in NATO and in the EU, but with nothing happening, it's all suddenly quite ambitious and moving forward.
Yeah, the whole point is about being able to move faster. How quickly do the EU actually want this military Schengen zone to be up and running and operational, though?
Yeah, I found myself thinking, oh God, now that it's so like clear that we're not ready at all to do something like this, I suddenly feel quite vulnerable and I want them to like sort it out immediately.
Yes, please.
So I can feel safe. And it seems like they feel that urgency too. They want it to be created by 2027.
Mm.
Will that be possible? we'll have to wait and see. It's always hard to get anything done very quickly in the European Union due to the need for getting agreement from all these different EU countries with their own political idiosyncrasies. But it does seem right now that there is a lot of energy behind this plan. Whether or not the necessary money will be found, that's another big question, of course.
Oh yeah, that 100 billion.
Yeah, and that's just the start of it. Anyway, I have to say that I found it surprisingly interesting reading up on this topic. So I actually will be keeping an eye on it. And I should mention that I'm really proud of myself. I've exercised a lot of restraint in not going deep into one key issue, the issue of railway gauges. Do you know what they are, by the way?
Is that like how wide the gap is between the rails?
Exactly. And there are like different dimensions depending on where you are in Europe. I really fell into a rabbit hole reading about this, and I think you'll be very happy to hear I edited it out.
It's like a really good use of your time.
Absolutely. Anyway, it is a really important part of this whole puzzle. So if anyone else is as much of a nerd as me and would like to read about railway gauges and whether Europeans' railways need re-gauging, can I direct you to the website of European train analyst John Worth? He has a piece on the question of whether or not we should re-gauge railways in Europe. I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Can't wait for that one. Genuinely, though, it does sound important. And we have a lot of train nerds who listen to this podcast, and I don't want to alienate them. So I genuinely will read that with great interest.
I am also one of them. So train nerds, this is a safe space for you. Anyway, Katie, who has had a bad week?
Yeah, I'm going to give Slovenia my bad week over a rather troubling law that was just passed. It's called the Šutar law. It's named after a 48-year-old man called Aleš Šutar, who was killed in a fight outside a nightclub last month in a town called Novo Mesto. What seems to have happened is that Aleš's teenage son called him in the early hours of the morning. He was on a night out. And he basically said, "Dad, I'm in trouble here with a group of Roma guys. Can you come and help me?" Aleš was actually the manager of a bar not far away, so he was able to get there pretty quick and find his son. And what happened next is quite unclear. There's no CCTV footage, but it appears that one of this group of young Roma men punched Aleš. He fell and he hit his head, and he died the next day in hospital. Now, Aleš's death came at an already really tense time for relations between Roma and non-Roma people in this part of Slovenia. It's in the southeast of the country where there is a sizable Roma population. The Roma who live over in the east near the border with Hungary, they are generally reported by rights groups to be like relatively well integrated into Slovenian society and the local economy. There is slightly less tension with the non-Roma population. In this region where Aleš Šutar was killed, it's a region called Dolenska, things have just been a tinderbox lately. The Roma people who live there are really, really poor. They live in terrible housing, often without access to water or sanitation. There's really high unemployment. And in recent years, there have been a lot of complaints from non-Roma Slovenians about crime that they blame on their Roma neighbours. And in this already very tense context, this dad is killed. He is a very well-liked person around this town. He'd been a DJ for years. He was the manager of this popular bar. Apparently a really warm and gregarious man, good listener to people who came to his bar. And this coming at a time when tensions over Roma people's place in this part of Slovenia has just been escalating and escalating. It just felt really explosive.
Awful story. And presumably this didn't just stay a local news story. Like this is something that became national news, I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. It has sparked a national uproar. People took to the streets over it. The interior minister and the justice minister both resigned. And then 2 weeks after Aleš dies, the government drafts very quickly this new law.
Two ministers resigned?
Yeah, the opposition actually wanted the entire government to resign over it. The prime minister, Robert Golob, has resisted that pressure. But I think the fact that two ministers were basically forced to step down over it, that shows like just how much this has snowballed since it happened.
And so what does it do, this new law that just passed?
Basically, it gives a bunch of new powers to the police. So under this new law, police will be able to enter a building without a warrant if they suspect that there are guns in there. they will be able to raid entire neighborhoods where there are concerns of criminal activity. So it formalizes this kind of collective suspicion of entire neighborhoods. It also gives the police the power to use technology like audio and video surveillance, drones, license plate recognition, if people's lives or property are considered to be at risk. It's pretty broad brush. The crucial detail is that these new, quite alarming powers will only apply in areas that are classified as security risk areas. Now, it's the police who are going to decide which those areas are, but it's generally understood that these areas are very likely to be areas where Roma people live. Other parts of the law also seem to have been written specifically with the Roma in mind, particularly this idea of the money for criminal fines being deducted from people's welfare payments. Once again, this is a very poor community with quite a lot of reliance on welfare. And while fans of this law have argued that it is right for this money to be taken away when a crime has been committed, critics have argued that taking money off welfare payments is just going to result in Roma kids going hungrier, essentially.
But this is not explicitly an anti-Roma law then, or is it?
No.
I mean, it doesn't say anywhere that Roma people are the target of these measures.
It doesn't, no. The law does not name any specific ethnic group. And the Prime Minister, Robert Golob, he has said this isn't a law that targets a specific ethnicity, it is a law that targets crime. But everybody knows and understands the context that this law was passed in. Like, it is about this Roma issue. And by the way, it is not a right-wing populist government that has brought this legislation in. Golob leads a coalition of left-wing and centre-left parties. A few left-wing parties have boycotted this law and the whole debate around it. They said it seemed repressive. But the bill passed with a huge majority in Parliament last week across the political spectrum, because politicians want to look like they are addressing these tensions between the Roma and non-Roma population and addressing them in a pretty hardline way. I should say that this bill has quite a lot of public support, about 60%, according to a poll for RTV. But maybe a useful bit of context is that there are elections coming up next spring. And right now, it is looking kind of likely that Janez Janša might be coming back as prime minister. You might remember him. Janša is an ally of Viktor Orban. He is a Trump fan, just to give you an idea of his politics. So this center-left government is quite desperate to look not weak on security at a time when the populist right is riding high in the polls just a few months ahead of an election. And that has resulted in them pushing a law that has really, really big implications for how policing works in certain communities. But this law hasn't really had much time or reflection put into it.
It's a pattern we see all across Europe when, like, more centrist governments come into power and then start, like, putting out policies that you'd expect from a more populist government.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly.
Looking at you, the UK.
Yeah, that's exactly who I was thinking of too. How are Roma people responding to the new law?
They're understandably really worried about this. Roma people who live in the area where Aleš Šutar was killed, they feel like they are being collectively blamed for his death. Reportedly, they are avoiding the town, they're avoiding the supermarket. But in general, Roma people feel like this law will effectively treat all of them as a security threat. You know, Roma people already get profiled by police across Europe for things like stop and search. They are often assumed to be guilty of something or other. In Slovenia, this law is likely to result in a situation where police can just barge into a Roma home for no real reason. All they need to say is like, oh, sorry, we thought there might be a gun in here. And the Roma Foundation for Europe, they issued quite a powerful statement about this. They said, laws like this do not reduce risk. They increase it. They widen the distance between groups, heat up the political atmosphere, and create conditions where a single rumor, insult, or street incident can escalate out of proportion. They also pointed out that, you know, what kind of signal does it send to the rest of the EU if an EU member like Slovenia, that is widely regarded as stable, it doesn't have like a crackpot populist government, what does it say if a country like that passes a law that implicitly targets a specific ethnic minority and the rest of the EU just kind of shrugs? The Roma Foundation have questioned whether this law is even legal under EU law when it comes to privacy and other things. And they asked the European Commission to take a look at it.
And have they responded yet?
So far, the Commission has done that very Commission thing of just saying something really bland. They have urged Slovenia to make sure that this law doesn't disproportionately affect any specific group. But it's really hard to see any scenario where it doesn't do that. I mean, it's hard talking about this, you know, like I wanted to talk to a Slovenian reporter who has covered this story because obviously I have no experience of what daily life is like in this rural part of Slovenia. I don't know what it's like to live with these tensions. And it is so sensitive that quite a few journalists just didn't want to talk to me about it. Friend of the show, Ursula Zeletel, put me in touch with a reporter who has been covering this story, and he's someone who knows this region really well. And he basically told me that there are valid complaints about rising crime in this region. It doesn't help anyone if you just pretend that isn't the case. And actually, the fact that people feel like nobody has done anything about these problems for years has made people feel a bit more liberated to use racist language about their Roma neighbors that they might not have done a few years ago. It does feel like Ada Šuta's death has brought things to a head and something has to change. But is this law really the right way to make things better? Like, I worry that so little time has been spent considering what the impact of this law is going to be. That's going to normalize a situation where a population that is already very marginalized will now get routinely abused by the police even more than they already do, and that it's going to continue to make people feel like hate speech is okay and actually end up making relations between Roma and non-Roma people worse than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a minority who are already pretty invisible across Europe, definitely not just in Slovenia. A lot of the discrimination that they face goes unnoticed and untalked about. And that is frankly because most of us don't know any Roma people. We live in parallel. All we tend to know about Roma people is that they are poor and stigmatized and that across Europe they get depicted as a people of criminals. And a lot of us are ignorant about just how dark this part of our history is. Like, we're talking about a population who were literally enslaved in what is now Romania for hundreds of years. Perhaps 500,000 of them were killed in Nazi concentration camps. But we didn't talk about this as the genocide that it is until really pretty recently. And all of that history is also part of the context when we see a country passing a law that might not specify this minority by name, but it does seem implicitly designed to allow police to barge into Roma homes with basically no excuse. And let's be real here, it is likely to lead to a lot of wrongdoings that will not be documented. So I think it's a really grim week. It's been said many times on this podcast that I think Slovenia is the best country in Europe. It is hands down the most beautiful country I have ever visited. And I very rarely have a bad word to say about it. But this week I'm giving Slovenia a very bad week.
Well, I'm glad you're finally bringing some balance to your Slovenia praise. Shame it has to be with such a disturbing story.
Gonna do some neutral journalism here. I wanted to say thanks, by the way, to JPS on Patreon for flagging this story up. It does seem somewhat underreported. We've actually had a couple of listeners reach out lately to ask that we talk more about Roma issues on the podcast. And they're right. We absolutely should.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't talk about Roma enough on the show, Europe's largest minority group. But it just so happens that next week we have an interview with a Roma expert. Angela Kotzer will be joining me and producer Katz Laszlo next week to talk about what the rise in far-right politics means for Roma people in Europe. It's that time in the show when we have to ask you for your money. I have a strong instinct inside of me telling me it is very uncouth to ask for money, but I'm fighting that instinct and doing it each week because donations from our listeners are the only way we can keep doing this show.
So brave of you, Dominic.
Thank you, Katie. This week, we'd like to shower the following listeners with our thanks for supporting us on patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Thank you to Clara, Jordan, Caroline, Elizabeth, Slavica, and also thanks to Astrid for increasing your donation.
Thank you all so much.
If you have anything, even just a few euros that you could part with without noticing it each month, we'd be so grateful. We really want to continue making this podcast for years to come, and that will only be possible with your support. I wonder if we count as the longest running independent podcast about Europe yet.
Oh, I reckon we probably do.
I think we probably do too. I should probably fact check that. But help keep us continue being the longest running independent podcast about Europe.
Yes, we would like to still be making this podcast when the military Schengen zone is up and running in approximately 32 years. Over the weekend, diplomats and scientists and other climatey people wrapped up the latest COP summit in Brazil. These are these annual climate conferences where we get together as a planet and supposedly work on solutions to climate change. This year's COP was, as Dominic has already alluded to, a huge damp squib. Somewhat astonishingly, the final joint statement coming out of it makes no explicit mention of fossil fuels, because countries couldn't come to an agreement that they could collectively say, we should be shifting away from fossil fuels. And honestly, it felt at the end of this year's COP, more than ever, like there is a big question mark over whether these meetings are getting us anywhere. Like, okay, it is amazing that we managed to come together for this, despite wars and trade disputes and everything else that's going on. The COP is where we came up with the Paris Agreement, this huge landmark goal of limiting the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. On the other hand, the UN Secretary General said last month that we have just missed this 1.5 degree target. We have failed. And there was a really blasé reaction to this. Like, okay, it was on the front pages of the news websites, but not for very long. And then we just kind of shrugged and moved on. Like, it feels like a really dispiriting moment for climate policy in general. It feels like loads of the momentum that we had a few years ago has just kind of dissipated.
It's true, but yeah, I don't want to be toxically positive, but did you see the good news from Denmark last week?
I did. Yeah, that's true. Denmark set some new climate targets last week that are way more ambitious than the EU ones. They want to cut their emissions by at least 82% by 2035, compared to what they were producing in the 1990s. But that is a rare bright spot. The mood in Europe is not good on this front. Ursula von der Leyen spent a lot of her last presidency of the European Commission pushing this Green Deal. Remember the Green Deal?
I remember the Green Deal. Feels like a distant past.
It was a set of relatively ambitious policies around the climate. Now, the Conservatives in the European Parliament are loosening some of the climate regulation that we do have. There has decidedly been a vibe shift when it comes to climate action in Europe, which has a lot to do with the way that politics is going, the rise of the far right in many countries. What do we do about that, given that climate change is already here, causing devastating floods and fires and heat waves, and that things are going to get worse, given that this is the fastest warming continent on Earth? We thought it would be interesting this week to speak to someone who was heavily involved in generating all of the momentum that we saw around climate action a few years ago. Luisa Neubauer is one of Germany's best-known climate activists, a kind of climate celebrity. She was one of the faces of the school strike movement in Germany about 7 years ago, and she has not stopped campaigning since. She's written about this so-called vibe shift and what we might be able to do about it. How are people like her feeling right now, given how much the mood has shifted and how much politics has shifted? Are they just giving up? I don't think so. I gave Luisa a call in Berlin. Luisa, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you were one of the key faces of Friday for Future in Germany a long, long time ago, back in 2018, when we saw this big wave of mass activism, you know, these huge protests demanding action on climate change. And governments at the time, at least here in Europe, were actually making changes, including in your own country, Germany, you know, carbon taxes, emission caps, like big concrete things. What did it feel like at the time? Did it feel like we were on the brink of something revolutionary happening?
So I think when you're inside that kind of, yeah, I would say close to revolutionary momentum and building up something with tens of thousands of other people who've all never done this before, or most of them have never done this before, to me, it was almost impossible to feel like surfing on a green wave. For me, and I guess a few others, in the very inside core of that movement, to us, it felt like we were trying to build a cathedral, but we'd never done this before. And the ground was sand. Mm. And we attempted to build higher and higher and higher and higher while having to kind of hold everything together at every single moment, because every day it could collapse completely and you didn't know what you were standing on. Mm. So while I look back and I appreciate so much what so many people made possible together, it's not that I would consider it to be emotionally spoken a very content time.
Yeah, it must be strange to look back at it now. I mean, to whatever extent this green wave you talk of did or didn't happen, it certainly doesn't feel like it's happening now. When did you first notice the way that action on climate change was kind of slipping down the to-do list of governments? Like, is there a specific moment you can pinpoint, or has it been a kind of gradual, imperceptible thing?
That's a very good question. And I obviously understand that this is a question that many people ask now, because now we see that climate is being ranked down in politics and public discourse. And yet I would just note that this isn't the first time that this ranking or rating down is happening. The first time I noticed that was in 2016, when the Paris Agreement had just been decided on. There was this world momentum. Everyone was talking about Paris. It was just so incredibly hopeful. And I mean, 1.5 degree as a promise to the world, to basically leave no one behind, to say, we're going to fight for you guys, no matter where you live. That felt historic to me. And I guess many other young people and me, we felt like this is a tipping point. This is a moment where we're going to focus on what is most important. And the first thing that then basically happened on a global stage was Donald Trump being elected and immediately leaving the Paris Agreement, which obviously to many felt like, okay, well, great, thanks for nothing. We had this Paris Agreement, but now that's, you know, gone down the hill. And the most important thing was then that people, including myself, but obviously many others, that we looked at that, we considered how history in the positive sense and in the negative sense had been made. And we decided not to let that stop us, but to then try even harder to bring climate to the agenda. And when we started as a climate movement, when I started with my climate activism, it was completely utopian to consider something like a country of Germany leaving coal energy behind. So now, as I see climate being kind of watered down, climate policies being watered down, as we see the greenwashing kind of rising beyond everything we've been seeing before, as we're seeing these lies, these excuses being made, I noticed that everywhere, and I think it has always been there before that green wave. And so right now, for me, most exciting is to think about what needs to happen so we kind of get to that mountaintop again.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think needs to happen? Are you still hopeful, even though we're seeing things like, I mean, here in Europe, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw centre-right members of the European Parliament teaming up with the far-right to roll back climate regulation. The vibe might have shifted with Trump a few years ago already, but here in Europe, it does feel like it is shifting definitively right now. Do you still see reasons for hope in the midst of all this? Like, what are you clinging to? What's driving you forward?
Very good question. I guess the first question here would be, what is hope? Do we understand hope as a promise or as a guarantee that is made to us that there will be a happy end, that will be delivered to our doorsteps, and we can kind of take it and then sit back down on the couch? That for me isn't hope. That maybe is very convenient optimism. But hope for me is not a state in which everything works out fine, or that thing I subscribe to get like immediate good news every day delivered to me. But hope for me is a promise that I make to the world that I will keep trying and that I will keep looking out for good people and good moments and good changes. And that means actively challenging my perspective on things. So say when we look in the world and we look at the European Parliament, what you just mentioned, we see, wow, that's really dangerous what's happening there. Yet if we just zoom out and maybe not consider the last months, but the last 10 years, we understand the fact that we are discussing climate as we are discussing it now, the fact that the far right can even team up to water down or dilute climate policies is only possible because we're doing so much more in terms of climate than even imaginable 10 years ago. And so for me, hope has to do with me doing something, with me teaming up, with looking out for the we. So who is the we that is doing something? And then looking closely and making it not so easy to tell that very singular story of things going either downhill or the way up, but paying attention to the nuances in between. And when I consider that, there's just so much reason for hope. There is the fact that how far we've come, the fact that people keep trying, the fact that what would have been maybe very normal thing to do, say the German government last week decided to give 350 million euros in subsidies to the aviation companies in Germany. That could have happened 10 years ago, just like that. But the difference is that today this caused a huge outcry and politicians and parliamentarians from all sides kind of teaming up saying, well, that's a bit ridiculous now, right? You know, there's not the time to give out these tax presents to some of the dirtiest companies without any conditions. We just don't do that. And so I can consider that kind of money transfer as being absolutely hopeless or a reason for hopelessness. Or I can consider the outrage around it to be something that is quite hopeful because that is something we've achieved, for instance.
That's a good change of perspective. I think I needed to hear that. But it is so crazy frustrating to see governments like Germany's doing that, things like that, right? Like, I mean, we're seeing...
it's very frustrating.
Subsidies for fossil fuels that we weren't seeing maybe a few years ago. Why are politicians doing this at the moment? I mean, not so long ago, we had a lot of European politicians arguing that like mass green investment is going to boost the economy. Mm. And now suddenly they're all saying, oh, well, cost of living, all of this stuff is too expensive. Like, why has the logic changed the way that they talk about these things?
Oh, that's a very good question. And I guess that's a whole new conversation that we could just possibly spend days on. But maybe just to name a few points on this. One is the cost of things has changed because when the promises were made, a lot of the investments were theoretical investments, you know, promising that things will happen. That's politically spoken a very cheap thing to do because you get the praise and you don't get the bill attached. And now it's pay time, you know, and now we see these investments must be made. And we are in this very strange crunch time where fossil-free investments don't pay off immediately. You know, building that railway that is super expensive, investing in that kind of carbon-free chemistry industry, that is huge money that is being spent. And it will pay off over decades in the best sense, but not tomorrow. So in this time where we are seeing, okay, the world is technically and mostly theoretically, but also in some places practically moving away from fossil fuels, we must make investments that are real investments and that they cannot justify with the benefits, financial benefits or economic benefits immediately. You must be able to justify them with that vision attached to it. And I think that is something we can change because that needs, you know, vision is something that politics can do. And there's a second reason why political arguments have changed so drastically is that obviously lobbying has come in. I mean, there's a reason why more than 1,000 fossil fuel lobbyists would go to the climate conference in Belém. They are afraid about the decisions that can be made there. And obviously, the third big reason is that at least a fraction of politics is, I would say, stuck in a fossil fuel ideology where not just in facts and data, but in your very emotional approach to the world, you find fossil fuel solutions are safer, economically more valuable, and are better, whatever that means for a country, than any fossil-free logic. And maybe the best example for that is the debate about the aesthetics of wind turbines. So why is it that every wind turbine has to be justified in terms of aesthetics? And no politicians ever questioned whether a coal mine is actually good for the landscape or not. And that is where we see this is about ideology, that's about that deep belief that fossil fuels give us something that fossil-free solutions cannot deliver.
Climate experts, diplomats, government advisors, lobbyists, they are all meeting in Brazil as we speak, at the COP, this big annual UN climate conference. By the time this interview goes out, everyone would have packed up and gone home. But right now, what are you hoping is going to come out of this year's COP?
This year's COP is obviously crucial for many of the financial talks, about the adaptation talks, so the question of who pays for the damages through climate catastrophes. It's about indigenous rights, about the rainforest. I would say one crucial to do for this year's COP is to make sure the world understands Donald Trump is an outlier and a planetary majority is moving towards decarbonization and a world without fossil fuels. And that is the challenge for this year's COP. That's why it's so important to just have states there to say, no, we're keeping going. We haven't agreed on everything. And there is greenwashing and that's a lobbyist. But we're doing that now. And that, I think, is a kind of wake-up call that we desperately need looking around the world.
I'm curious about what your own journey has been like as a climate activist. How has your own understanding of climate change and climate action changed over time? Like, are there things that you have changed your mind about? What do you see now that you didn't see a few years ago?
So I would say probably the most profound thing that has changed for me is my personal understanding of science and facts in the climate discourse. So when I started as a climate activist and I had my first meetings with heads of state, Macron invited us to the Elysee and Obama showed up and we met Merkel and all these people. And I was convinced that the absence of ambitious climate politics was the consequence of almost a political error where some of the climate data had just been not acknowledged enough or overseen. So I thought they'd just kind of forgotten that in a drawer. And we need to kind of put it out again and say, hey, there's this thing, you know, it doesn't make sense what you do right now because I can't be strong economies or, I don't know, strong democracies even when, you know, the planet's on fire, that's just not working out.
Just and a reminder.
So, you know, and I really thought in it that I didn't know any other chancellor than Merkel. And I was convinced about the kind of politics of the reason. And that obviously was hugely naive. And I would say also looking back, I find cute, like in a cute way, like part of my very strong democratic belief that politics was really trying to do the best it could. And if it didn't, it was just like this error that we had to correct. Mm-hmm. I didn't back then think about these huge kind of systems that are designed to fail many people and about the politics of lobbyism and so on. So back then when we started about talking about the facts and the data, I couldn't understand the outcry, the backlash, the hatred. Today, when I go to any public event, when I go to kind of, I don't know, climate protest right now, I have to bring personal security people with me because that is how much I'm attacked in the public, not by a majority, obviously not, but this by the small, very violent minority.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. And I think what has changed for me is the understanding that when we talk about climate, when we talk about climate science, we never talk about climate and climate science alone. Being an activist in Germany for climate means facing the fact that for an identity of our country, fossil fuels meant escaping fascism and our deeds of the Second World War and finally becoming someone that you can talk to again. That was cars and coal and this industry that was built up on the backs of these bodies of those men and these mines. And, you know, I can come around and show the data and say, hey, you know, guys, there's a calculation. It kind of doesn't make sense. It's getting really expensive. But as long as we don't have an alternative vision, an alternative identity to offer, as long as we also maybe ignore that in order to change the path we're on, we must be able to pay respect to that path because it has been built up with people's sweats and efforts. I think all these things kind of came up quite a bit later.
A lot of climate activists have rallied behind the Palestinian cause since 2022. There's been a lot of division over this within the activist movement. You've gained some criticism from others inside the activist movement for what they have seen as too pro-Israel a position. I wondered what your thoughts are on how all of this has been covered, if your thoughts have changed about all of this.
Well, definitely my thoughts have changed. And I hope many people's thoughts have changed after what we saw in the last 2 years. What happened, I think, after October 7th is that in Germany, as a country that obviously has a big backstory to everything, there was an enormous expectation being set on people like me to, from a German perspective, be there where the German state would be. And that would mean for our government, for many politicians, would mean standing unconditionally, and that is a huge, the crucial term here, unconditionally on the side of Israel. Whereas in many parts of the world, obviously, the eyes were on everything that happened in Gaza and Palestine. And as a climate movement, working in Germany, that was a impossible position to be in, as I found. And I didn't have the vision, but also, to be very honest, not the courage to kind of take a step back and reflect on that position. Me and others, we felt like we cannot deliver here, and we want to be in solidarity with everyone that is both affected from October 7th and the Jewish life that must be protected, and also obviously set in solidarity with everyone in Gaza, with the people there, with those who are affected by, for instance, racism, anti-Muslim racism. And we thought that if we just clarify that we stand in solidarity, that our hearts are big, you know, that we are seeing the suffering that is happening everywhere, that we could continue working as we did. And what I completely underestimated is how strong these forces were that tried to streamline, I would say, that one singular story that would be told about October 7th, where a lot of the suffering that happened on many ends would not be visible. And that it would have taken many more people to break through that. And luckily enough, many people, especially in Germany, did a lot of that very courageous work to very much challenge singular narratives and try to at least make space for multiple sufferings and their stories and their backgrounds. And I'm very, thankful for that. What I see around in communities here in Germany, and that I think is very hopeful, is that there is a real attempt to both reflect what has happened, to take responsibility, also happening in politics more and more, and working towards an understanding of maybe that critical solidarity where we do not have to agree with everything and everyone in order to align on, you know, the very basic ends that we're fighting on.
Well, I want to thank you, Louisa, for taking the time to speak to me today and to answer my questions. So much honesty and vulnerability. Just a final question for you. We have a fairly young audience for this podcast, and they care a lot about climate change, but not everyone knows how to get active, how to make a difference. It's really easy to feel overwhelmed. What would you say to encourage people who want to join the climate movement in some way, but they don't even know where to start?
First of all, I would recommend to not fall for this trap where they tell you need to be a perfect environmentalist in order to earn the right to be an activist, to be outspoken, to be authentic. Second thing, 50% of activism is showing up. So look up. Where is the meeting happening? Where is a Zoom call I can join in? Where is that gathering? Where is that protest? And then we need people to be involved sustainably. So don't think about that one singular thing to do, but maybe consider more what kind of routine do you wish in your life? Because effectively, let's be honest, we're going to spend the rest of our lives in the climate crisis, and we're going to see devastation that we can't even imagine yet. And it's going to be horrible. It's going to be horrible for the hearts and the souls and the minds. And for that, we need spaces and places where we are safe and where we can, you know, be courageous and where we can train to be courageous and where we can reflect on what stops us from being courageous. And that means find that group of people, find that one friend, maybe that one person to talk to that will hold you accountable if you don't show up, that will inspire you to even maybe grow beyond what you've been seeing before, and that will make it hopefully fun to do stuff. And we need people to have the best time, because obviously, you know, it's hard enough to be out there. So we must make it fun. We must have the better music and we must have the better parties. And then I can only say choosing the life of activism has been the best decision of my life. It's been the most liberating thing I could have done for myself, knowing that I do not have to watch in silence as things unfold. I can be part of those who try to create some hope.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed talking to the Weezer. It's always cool to hear public figures talking publicly about how their thinking has changed. I really appreciate that kind of learning in public. And there were certain things I'd never thought about before, particularly the way that she talked about how our feelings about climate change are rooted in culture and history. You can join Luisa's 700-something thousand Instagram followers at Luisa Neubauer. She posts in German and in English. And if you too are trying to fight the vibe shift and at least keep educating yourself about climate action, she's a great person to follow. Back to your train metaphor, Dominic. Let us chug into the inspiration station. What have you been reading about apart from railway gorges? Gouges?
Yeah, actually, I've been saying gorges, but is it gouge?
Fellow train nerds, write in and let us know. What have you been enjoying, though?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to be boring and talk about another new European music release again, except this time it's a new release by a little old German fella called Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, wait, is he still around?
No, he did die 275 years ago, but two new organ pieces have been rediscovered in the collection of the Royal Library of Belgium. And a researcher called Peter Volney has spent 30 years trying to authenticate the pieces as true works from the master, J.S. Bach. Volney has now got to a point where he is 99.9% certain that these two pieces are indeed genuine works of Bach. Works that he wrote between the ages of 18 and 20. Wow. And last week, they were performed for the first time in over 300 years by the Dutch organist Ton Koopman at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, where Bach himself was director of music.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. The two pieces, a chaconne in D minor and a chaconne in G minor, can be heard in two videos from the German broadcaster DW. I'll share a link to them in the show notes.
What's a chaconne?
A chaconne is a type of musical composition which usually has a repeated ground bass, so a repetitive, like boom, 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 like hit the road jack or something. I guess that's a chaconne.
Oh, that's a chaconne.
Yeah.
I've learned something today. Thank you. I'm going to get my chaconne on.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
This is quite bad, but I have got a target of reading 12 books this year, one for every month. And I've been in a bit of a panic because it's late November and I have got two books left to read. Ooh. So I was looking for something short. And it turns out that the celebrated Italian physicist Carlo Rovelli has written a bunch of really short books.
Oh, great. About physics.
About physics. So ironically, I have been reading a book about the physics of time because I feel like I haven't got enough time.
I mean, even a short book about physics sounds like it would take quite a long time to read.
It did hurt my brain.
A small brain.
Quite a lot. But actually, it's been a really good reminder that, you know, none of this matters. We are so tiny and insignificant. There are huge forces at play at the universe. So yeah, I've just finished The Order of Time, which is classic Rovelli. It was first published in 2017, but what is time? You know, what is recent? Who cares? And I would describe this book as short, but mind-blowing. It is about the physics of time, but also about the philosophy of time and how our thinking about time has changed through the ages. Rovelli is one of these public intellectuals who is just so incredibly gifted at communicating what makes their work exciting. He's always using metaphors that make these really complicated ideas feel accessible. There's this one really nice moment where he describes moments in time as being chaotic like Italians rather than forming an orderly queue like English people.
Lovely.
which he can say because he is Italian. His writing is really beautiful and it has been beautifully translated into English by Erica Segre and Simon Carnell. And I feel like if you ask me anything about quantum physics for the next week, I will probably be able to answer you quite confidently. After that, probably not. But it's okay. I can just read another Carlo Rovelli book because they're really short.
Okay, so next week you're doing a good week or a bad week that's about physics.
God.
That's your challenge.
I am going to live to regret this.
And oh, I've got a good tip for if you want another short book before the end of year. Have you read Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan?
Ah.
That's a really good book to read this time of year because it's set around Christmas and it's only like 130 pages long and it's so beautiful. It was a massive hit when it came out like 4 years ago. So loads of people will have read it already. And it's a film, which I think wasn't meant to be very good, but the book is amazing.
Perfect. Book number 12 sorted. Thank you very much.
Before we finish the show, for this week's happy ending, I want to send birthday greetings to Italy's oldest barista.
Hmm.
Guess how old she is?
Oh, 93?
Anna Possi turned 101.
Amazing!
And she has been serving coffee at Bar Centrale for over 6 decades.
Fantastic. Which city is she in? What part of Italy?
She's in the village of Nebbiuno, which is a village that looks over Lake Maggiore. Oh. And she opened this Bar Centrale, with her husband in 1958.
Wow.
Can you believe it? She's actually been working in hospitality for even longer than that. Her first job serving coffee was back during the Second World War.
Mm.
You might be thinking, take a break, Anna. Mm-hmm. You deserve it. But apparently she has no plans of slowing down. And hey, if you love your work, then why not keep going? Maybe we'll carry on making this podcast until we're 101.
Don't even joke about it.
Tanti auguri, Anna.
Tanti auguri.
That's all we've got time for this week. This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs, mixed and mastered by Wojciech Oleksiak, and there was editorial support from Kat Laszlo. We'll be back next week in your feeds on Thursday. In the meantime, check us out on all the socials. Where can they find us, Katie?
Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and YouTube. And as of tomorrow morning, via our new newsletter on Substack.
Yes, please all go and subscribe. Have a great week, everyone.
Stay warm.
Adieu.
Adieu.